The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 32, August 27th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into Show 32, I want to remind all the listeners that there are four ways to contact the show. First is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, through the website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, through voicemail at 206-600-4216, and by regular mail at the Lima Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065. Now, today's show is a long show. It's a little over an hour. It has a lecture given by Keith 418 called Strategic Planning for Magicians. And this lecture was given at Theory on Babylon Oasis on June 3rd, 2006. However, before getting into that, I want to get into some listener feedback. The first is an email that was sent in July, so I'm very overdue in replying to this. Dear Thelema Coast to Coast, first off, I want to say the show is fantastic. I found the podcast on MySpace through a banner linking to your MySpace page. The first show I listened to was Show 26. After hearing the podcast, I was blown away and been very interested ever since. And like most new listeners, I've been going back and listening to the older shows as well. Keep up the great work. But the reason I'm emailing you is concerning a question about Thelema and practice. The question is, does nihilism, nihilist views play a role at all in Thelema? Your thoughts and opinions would be greatly appreciated. Well, there are two ways you can kind of look at nihilism in this. In the more philosophical way of saying that there is nothing, that is, that the universe is ultimately non-dual. And this is actually what I will be talking about in my lecture in the next podcast, Show 33, a lecture that I gave at Dove and Serpent Oasis about the ontology of Thelema, based on Beresheath Crowley's essay about ontology. However, there is another aspect of nihilism where that means that things lack any inherent meaning. And Thelema can be accused of having that. Since we don't posit any god or any transcendent deity that gives us meaning, we are open to criticism that we don't have any kind of larger universal meaning. However, Thelema counters that and says, no, actually, it isn't nihilistic because the will, the supreme value and supreme meaning maker within the individual, gives an individual their point or their meaning. And therefore, it supersedes any kind of nihilistic tendency, because if you're in accordance with your true will, you actually have a universal meaning. It is manifesting in the macrocosm with yourself, but it also extends into the microcosmic universe in that your will is in alignment with the universal will. However, you have to know your will, or you have to be working towards that. So certain things that you do can ultimately lead to nihilistic or have nihilistic tendencies, and those are ultimately not within your true will. However, the things that are within your true will are within the universal will and ultimately give you meaning within the microcosmic being that you are. I hope that makes sense. Anyway, for people who want to know before my lecture comes out what I'm talking about on the the nihilistic or the nothing ultimate levels of being within the universe. There are two essays I recommend from Crowley. The first is Bear Sheath. It's in the second collected works. You can get that online. And then also within Magic Without Tears, there is a chapter called Zero Equals Two, and Crowley talks about a lot of this. So if you want to read about nihilism and its place within Thelema, those are two great places to go read from Crowley. And again, that will be the kind of subject I have on the next podcast. So thanks for that email. The next one is from Bob in Cornwall. He says, 93, John. Just got to say, I bought Lon Milo Duquette's CD after hearing it on your show, and it's brilliant. The perfect antidote to the depression that can set in, while I imagine all that Keith 418's target setting and transparency will turn the OTO into something like Blair's Britain. Still loving the show. I never thought you would be able to keep up the high-quality output this long. 93's Bob. Well, Bob, I'm glad you like the show, and I'm glad you like Lon Duquette's CD. I'm talking to Lon about having him on another future show so I can talk to him about the CD and some of his newer books. I find it amusing that you think the ideas of transparency and target setting and things like that are depressing. I personally think that they are very meaningful and they really could move the OTO forward. Having goals does not mean that it's going to be boring and political like Blair's Britain or the Bush administration. We could have goals of manifesting the blue equinox. We could have goals of manifesting a Thelemic culture and Prophis houses and things like that. So it all just depends on how you approach it. And actually, this leads into a lot of what the lecture about strategic planning for magicians is about. So, Bob, I hope you take a listen to the lecture given by Keith 418, and maybe you'll look at this a little differently. The last listener feedback is a voicemail. So here it is, and then I'll respond afterwards. This is a longer reply, which actually is something I like.
Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Greetings, John, in 93. This is Freighter Controversy from Buffalo, New York, USA. Today I wanted to contact you for three reasons. Number one, Thelema Coast to Coast is a wonderful success, and I especially enjoy your discussions with Keith 418. These discussions are always intelligent, logical, and thought-provoking. It both amazes and saddens me that with only about 3,000 members worldwide, the OTO has no long-term goals. This is completely outrageous. I would think that at a minimum, there would be the goal of attracting new members and growing the membership. I have also enjoyed your lectures that you have broadcast and the interviews with the various luminaries from the Thelemic and occultic communities. I enjoyed your recent talk with Keith about Liber E, and I hope that you will cover other important Libers in the weeks and months to come. Thelema Coast to Coast is my favorite podcast, and I am always looking forward to the next one as it just keeps getting better and better. Number two, I would like to recommend two topics for forthcoming shows. On the Thelema Coast to Coast message board, several of us have expressed an interest in when might be the proper time to introduce our children to Thelema. Additionally, is there an extant syllabus for the child student which might show the most appropriate things to teach at the corresponding appropriate age? Surely there must be a ceremonial magician out there who has already done this with his or her own child or children, and I would appreciate this being covered in a future show. Even though my own son is not yet 2 years old, he has already shown an intense interest in my magical jewelry, books from my magical library, ritual tools, and temple furniture. Additionally, I would also enjoy some information on Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page as a ceremonial magician and Thelemite. Your interview with Eric Davis about his book on the occult and magical aspects of Zeppelin IV only serve to whet my appetite for more information on this part of Jimmy's life. I don't know if this is even doable for a complete lack of data, but nonetheless, it would be fascinating to learn something about which I've wondered for all these years, since I first saw Do What Thou Wilt Shall Be the Whole of the Law scratched into the inner groove of my copy of the Led Zeppelin III vinyl LP way back in 1970. Finally, I would like to recommend a guest for your show, the phenomenal occult artist who calls himself Nemo. His artist website and internet store at nemosutopia.com is an occultic and psychedelic trip in time, space, color, and symbol. Inside his artwork, Nemo places occult symbolism and sigils, and his work must be seen to be believed. Nemo is a personal friend and a brother in the occult community, and I believe that your listeners would enjoy knowing about both him and his work. You can contact Nemo directly by going to nemo.org, and once you are there, click on the link Hire Nemo. Then, once that page loads, click on the link Email Nemo at the bottom of the page. His artwork is so unique that I think he would make an excellent guest for the show. These are my three comments for today. Please keep up the excellent work, and know that we listeners really appreciate all the hard work that you've put into Thelema Coast to Coast, a wonderful fulfillment of your true magical will. Love is the law, love under will.
Thanks for taking the time and sending such a thoughtful reply. It's clear that you really thought about all the different things that you wanted to say and kind of organized it before you called, and that's wonderful. So the first thing I want to respond to is your two suggestions for topics. The first one was magical or thelemic parenting, when to introduce magic and magical ideas to children. This is an area that I am completely unqualified to discuss. I have no children, I'm divorced, and I actually have absolutely no interest in having children. So this is not an area that I really could speak authoritatively about. However, I'm sure there are lots and lots of people out there who have raised their children in a thelemic manner or a magic or pagan manner. So if listeners out there could give me some feedback on suggestions, maybe I can compile them all and in a future show kind of take a look at some of these things. And also, if there's anybody out there who has some kind of background in not just child rearing, because there's lots of Thelemites out there who are raising children, which is wonderful, but somebody who also has more of an academic or professional background in child development, so that I could talk to that person about child development and introducing ideas about paganism or Thelema magic and so forth. So anybody who's got those kind of suggestions, please send them to me. Second suggestion for a guest was about Jimmy Page and Thelema and his interest in Thelema and magic and so forth. I have absolutely no access to Jimmy Page or anybody out there who does. Or Jimmy Page, if you're listening, I would love to have Jimmy on the show. If that is even remotely possible, that would be great. Or if anybody who is familiar with Jimmy can give some feedback or come on the show or something like that, email me and let me know you're out there, and we can see what we can do. Now, the suggestion of Nemo and the utopia and art and so forth, that sounds very interesting. Actually, I have been thinking about doing a show about art in the new eon, so Nemo might be a guest for that. I'm still kind of in the development phase for that, so that might be later this year, but I appreciate the suggestion. And I also appreciate the other comments that you gave. So thanks for taking the time and sending that in. All right, that about does it for listener feedback today. I could be doing a bunch of other emails, but this is a very long lecture given by Keith. So I want to get right into it. And so here's Keith 418 talking about strategic planning for magicians at Theory on Babylon Oasis.
Welcome to the class today on strategic planning. I wanted to sort of give a little bit of a background introduction about me and why I'm doing the strategic planning training. You might be sitting asking yourselves, why you, Keith? 418, why are you the person doing the strategic planning? And just to give you a little bit of background about me, I came out to the Bay Area in 1986 after I graduated from Boston University. I knew no one. I had no contacts in the area. I had never been west of somewhere in the middle of Pennsylvania before in my life. Just decided to come out to San Francisco, thought it would be fun, stayed in youth hostels, got a place on the Hay, and started looking for a job. And the job market then was awful. But I did find a job working for a peace group that was located in the most god-awful office you can imagine in San Francisco. And it was in a little hole-in-the-wall, terrible, sleazy office with furniture that had literally been dragged from the street after other people had thrown it out. So our director always referred to it as the spanky and alfalfa in the clubhouse furniture from the Little Rascals, which we had managed to salvage. The organization had very little money, had done very little training, didn't have a lot of plans about what it was going to do, and no resources, almost nothing. It was dirty, and the people who were working for it, the guy who started the office was a former house painter from Connecticut, you know, not really well educated, and most of the people working there were crazy. Hippies, wackazoids, people drifting in off the street, marginal characters. Someone once was talking about, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel of the job market. It was very frustrating trying to hire people because we couldn't pay anybody, and we were working for a peace cause that wasn't even popular among the left at the time. But starting in 1986, over a period of 13 years, we went to having a budget of $1 million, 400,000 members in the state, making us the largest group of its kind in the United States, with our own newsletters, huge amounts of our own training programs, our own building, and basically went from night to day. Now the organization has a budget of over $3 million in its 20th year in San Francisco. And at the same time, all of the other competing groups, which looked really marvelous and wonderful when we were starting and that we envy, have mostly gone into the dustbin of history, including some other groups that worked around us and were very patronizing and sort of mean to us. As the little Oliver Twist peace activists that we were, they sort of looked down at us and told us that we were silly, but they're all gone, and our group is still around and flourishing with, you know, huge amounts of resources, and is actually planning on retaking the whole United States, even away from the group that spawned it. They're moving into other states, they're starting new offices, so it's going great. Now, often people would ask us, how did you do that? Especially the people who'd seen us when we were starting, when we were in this grubby office with no furniture. Now, how did you go that way? And I'll never forget this one guy in Portland went, well, they live in California, and everybody in California is liberal, so of course they got the money. Which drove my director into like a fit of anger because, you know, he had this vision of us sitting there catching checks just sort of falling from the sky. You know, just, let's put a few buckets out and people will throw gold into them, which is not how it happened. In real terms, if you were to ask me, Keith, you know, what's the single explanation for this? Was it good luck? No, we had crappy luck. Was it a successful political climate? Not at all. We had no luck, politically speaking. We had setback after setback. Was it media? No, we have no media. This group still has no media presence. In fact, the only time it was covered by the media was by a right-wing San Francisco newspaper that, you know, some college student wrote the paper for it and they published it because they didn't have anything else to publish. We've never gotten positive media from anybody. So what was it? It was strategic planning. The group knew how to do strategic planning, and that was it. And that's so. This is my experience for 13 years when I worked for the group. So that's why I'm giving the briefing, because that's something I do know something about. I taught other people how to do it. I taught other groups how to do it, and I experienced it. So that's my background. We can ask, what is strategic planning? Now, I looked into this, and you know, our recent visit from our bishop, he started out by talking about the meaning of various words. Strategy comes from the word strategem, which is a Greek word, and it means the position of the general. You can sort of understand military strategy. We're sort of familiar with this. My personal definition of strategic planning is planning that builds towards something. And my favorite model of this is my wife. When she was an infant, according to her mom, knew that the cookies were kept in a high cupboard. And so she got a chair and a box and a smaller box and climbed on the chair, climbed on the box, climbed on the smaller box and reached into the cupboard and grabbed the cookies. And we've all had that experience as children, I'm sure, step by step going to get the cookies. And that's strategic planning in a nutshell, which seems pretty simple, and it is. The other context I'd sort of like to phrase this in is strategic planning as it applies to occult organizations. And my model for this, my analogy, is going to be the television show The Family Guy, which we should all be familiar with, and the television show South Park, which we should all be familiar with. And in a recent episode of South Park, one of the main characters complained about the TV show Family Guy and the way it was structured. Because if you've watched Family Guy, you know, it's a 30-minute show, 22 minutes minus the commercials. And the characters just sort of go off on these little funny reveries all the time, little memories, little flashbacks, they're humorous. But in the end, there's not really a coherent narrative that these all sort of fit into. You know, it's just, oh, I remember when I opened a falafel stand with Mr. T. And you're like, ah, that's funny. Or, you know, oh, that reminds me of the time. Okay. And then at the end of the show, it's over. And, you know, you remember some of these little bits, but the whole overarching structure is seldom there. South Park, on the other hand, every episode has a theme, usually a fairly didactic one, if you'll think about it. And all the jokes in the episode lead towards reinforcing the major theme at the end, which is the lesson learned in the situation that's been exposed. And one of the characters was complaining that Family Guy is too easy. Because it's too easy to write a show in which it's just one unconnected joke after another versus having to come up with jokes that are all connected together. That's a bitch to write. So obviously the writers of South Park were angry at the success of Family Guy because they saw people taking the easy way out and getting lots of laughs and lots of credit, and they didn't like that. So this narrative structure, I think, is interesting in an occult context because we can ask ourselves, in terms of strategic planning, what do occult groups lead to? If the process is like my wife when she was a little girl going to get the cookies, what cookie is at the end of the process of any occult organization? And I like to compare this to the Golden Dawn, which is a group most of us are familiar with. We study it in the course of our magical training. Most of us are very familiar with Israel Regardi's books. And if you'll notice, you know, at the beginning of the Golden Dawn, you learn the Hebrew alphabet. And then you learn various forms of divination. And then you learn, you know, how to make talismans. And then you learn how to construct weapons. And there's little rituals in between. But where is it all going? What's it all adding up to? And it is going somewhere. It may not be going somewhere that people in the Golden Dawn like too much, or are happy or thrilled about or even aware of. But it seems to me that in a lot of ways the Golden Dawn has become kind of the Family Guy model of occult organizations, where each one of these little sections, these little lessons on astral traveling or weapon creation or divination with the tarot, is interesting and people go and study it, but it doesn't seem to be leading anywhere the way the South Park model would. And the OTO, on the other hand, is much more like South Park and a lot less like Family Guy in that it is leading towards a certain definite place. Do we know what the definite place the OTO model is leading towards in its initiations, in its teachings, in its rituals? Where is it going? What is it there to do?
To unite us with the infinite, to gain wisdom.
Okay, that's a little too vague. That sounds good. I'm looking for something a little bit more specific. If you were to say to somebody, you know, what...
Aging society.
Okay, that's also... We're hoping that that's the case. The end point of the OTO is the ninth degree. There are degrees after it. But, you know, Crowley says over and over again, the sanctuary of the ninth degree sort of is the end point of the OTO. And the OTO is founded to get you, if you work hard and get the instructions, up to that mystery and that gnosis. So if someone says to you, you know, what's the point of the OTO? It's like, well, these initiations lead towards a very definite thing. They're not like Family Guy where it, bing, 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 bing. Where is it all going? Oh, I'm not really sure. But the little bits are good. And I would argue that unless you're really sure where the occult group is going or have a very definite idea, you're probably being strung along into a series of maybe good little bits, but in the end, nothing substantial. So strategic planning is not about funny little bits that at the end of which you look back and say, ah, that was okay, or that was a good one, or that wasn't. It's actually leading towards a definite place, the cookies in the cupboard. Okay. Is that clear? Okay. So, the definition that I am using for strategic planning also looks at certain components that it has to have. So you're looking at strategic planning and you can say to yourself, well, is this a strategic plan or not? To be a strategic plan, one, it needs to involve the leaders of the group, whatever the group is, whether it's a cult group or a nonprofit. Why? Why must a strategic plan for an organization involve the leaders?
So they're the ones that make up the plan?
Well, yeah, but they're the ones who control the group, right? And they control its direction. So let's say, you know, we all decide to come up with a plan for international OTO in the 2 hours following the meeting. We postpone the mass, and we decide we're going to come up with this. Is that really a strategic plan? No. Okay, it may be an enjoyable exercise. It may be a waste of time. But it is not a real strategic plan because the leaders of the organization who will put the plan into effect and make the decisions that make the plan happen are not involved. You know, unless somebody here is a secret member of the upper chamber of the International OTO, which could be possible, nonetheless, I'm going to doubt it. It is not a real strategic plan. So the leaders of the group have to be involved in the plan for it to be a strategic plan. Now, does that mean we could come up with a plan? We could. It would not be a strategic plan in any real sense. It would be a fantasy. It would be fun. It could be cool exercise. Not really a plan. So the next category is, it was created by studying the possible effects of changes both within and without the organization. Now, why would strategic planning have to involve calculating the effects both within and without the organization? All right, let's look at this. If you come up with a strategic plan, will it affect the people within the organization? Obviously, because they must be the ones working on that plan. Outside the organization, it's going to see what the organization will do in the larger sphere. You know, you were talking about changing society. Who was talking about changing society? Okay, if it's a plan to change society, we have to detect what effect our plan is going to have on the society. Now, the best kinds of strategic planning are like this sort of, you know, step-by-step process towards the cookies. And if the first part of your plan doesn't change the organization itself, you're not going to be able to get to that next step. So the change that you want to have within the organization and the change you want to have outside of it have to sort of bounce off each other and mutually reinforce each other to be a true strategic plan. Just keep that in mind, because this is like the best of both worlds scenario. In the best of both worlds, your plan helps get what you want in the outside world. Like, hey, everybody starts, you know, doing what we want them to do in the larger sense of things. And it also helps the group within, which is, you know, makes sense. If we want X to happen outside, we should have a benefit inside the group. Next, the strategic plan will influence the governance, leadership, and operations of the organization. This sounds kind of brain dead, right? It'll affect the organization, it'll affect the governance, affect the performance. But let's consider something. Could we come up with a plan that would have absolutely no effect on the operation of the organization at all? We could. Would it be a strategic plan? No. It would be useless. If we came up with a plan and it wouldn't affect the governance, why have the plan? The people running the organization are using the plan, so it has to have some effect on them. They have to be involved with it, and we're using the plan to gauge the performance. If we have a plan and we don't change anything that we do, then it's not really a plan.
It's a diversion.
It's a diversion, maybe, it's an exercise, it's a theoretical thing, but it's not really a plan. Lastly, the plan must use the resources of the organization. And by that I mean what? Money. And other things. But it's easier to think about it first as money. So for example, let's think about this. What if I said, you have to come up with a strategic plan for your local body, but you're not going to get a budget. I don't care how you get the money. I'm not going to give you any money. The money isn't going to come from the group, but you have to come up with this plan. That's not really a strategic plan. It's, again, it's a diversion, it's an exercise, but unless it really involves the resources, unless you see money involved in this, it's not really a strategic plan. Because the real strategic plan is happening with what? The money. Okay? And this is the thing that I want people to think about as they analyze strategic plans at work or in other environments. Is it really dealing with the money? Where's the money going? Because if the money isn't going into the plan, it's probably not a real plan. The money's going into the real plan. All right. Now, one of the things that people talk about when they talk about strategic planning is the idea of where is it going? You know, what's the ultimate goal? And in order to formulate that ultimate goal, you need vision. We're going to talk about this a little bit more later. But at some point, when my wife was trying to get the cookies, she had a vision of where the cookies were and the satisfaction of eating the cookies. So if a strategic plan is dealing with an ultimate issue, there should be a vision somewhere of what the result of that is going to be. Now, since we're all evil black magicians here, I decided to quote from one of the most dangerous magical texts known to mankind, the Necronomicon, which we all know in real terms is the Bible. And from Proverbs 28, verse 18, the line comes to us, where there is no vision, the people perish. That's from the King James Version, which is, we know, the most satanic of all biblical translations. So without vision, there's no goal. It's not going to happen. Don't do strategic planning. And the next question comes, well, how do you get that vision? If you're going to do strategic planning, how do you get that vision? In certain circumstances, the vision is going to be given to you. It's going to be kind of obvious. If you don't have an obvious vision, I have another suggestion from the Temple of Psychic Youth, which says to explore daily your deepest desires, fantasies, and motives, gradually focusing on what you would like to have happen in a perfect world, a perfect situation, taking away all restrictions and practical considerations, what you'd really want. So if you want to come up with a vision, either for yourself as an individual or for an organization that you're involved with, that is a process that you can work on to get that vision. Now, it's tricky because, as we all know, that people will get lost in that, you know, imagining the perfect world and be content with the imagination. Toby immediately says, then go to work on making that happen. And that's what strategic planning is about. It's making that vision happen. Now, as we contemplate vision and what we want, it becomes clear to us that often we know what we don't want more than we want. And if people start thinking about this, it'll occur to them that in general, it's easier to get people to start thinking about what they don't want than what they want in many circumstances, especially when it comes to organizations. Well, we don't want something that's too bossy. We don't want something that's too exclusive. We certainly don't want anything that's too elitist. You know, we don't want to exclude anyone. We don't want to make it too hard. And I think it's easier for us in the modern period to come up with the things that we don't like than it is to come up with the things we like. And when you ask people what they really want, often it's phrased in terms of what they don't want. Like, I really want a environment that doesn't exclude anyone. Well, that's you're talking more about what you don't want than what you want. But the perfect place becomes this void of unpleasant things rather than something that you really want. So I would think about that too. The ultimate is where we're going to end up. Now, strategic planning will help us with this by providing focus and an alignment of resources. In a magical context, if you are planning on doing an invocation, which involves planning, if it doesn't involve planning, please stay the hell away from me. If you're doing magical work and you don't make a checklist and you don't start planning it out ahead of time, I don't really, please don't bring it up. This is like this weird kind of chaos magic, like, I don't do magic now. Whoever's here. Please don't do that. So let's say we were going to invoke a planet like Mars. What would we do? We'd go to 777 and we start looking at things like, what's the angel to make a talisman for? What hours does Mars show up? Is Mars in a good position right now? We look at maybe Tuesdays. We look at the incense. What's the drug for Mars? Does anyone know? Tobacco. Yeah, go and buy some cigars and some cigarettes, right? So we're going to need them. All these things help us do what? They help us align our resources. And that's what a strategic plan helps you do. And focus. So this sort of will formation is something we already know how to do. We do this when we do invocations. The second thing it will do for you is enhance satisfaction in actually getting things done. And wouldn't you all like to be in a group that actually gets things done versus a group that doesn't? That's inherently something that's satisfactory, right? Being involved in things that you never get what you want is lame. Getting what you want is good. And basically the result here is a tangible result versus spin. You know, if you work on getting something that you want, you feel satisfied. You cannot work at all and try to spin that whatever you have is what you wanted all along. But I think that the clock is running out on that as an option in life. So basic enhanced satisfaction. The next issue is solving problems. You know, most of the time, magic actually occurs because you have a problem or a deficit that you want to see solved. Strategic planning is no different. If there are problems, strategic planning will let you solve them versus spinning about them. It will help you improve conditions, both within your organization and out. That's obvious. The next one that our book gives us is credibility and issues. What kind of credibility are we talking about here? Now, when I bring this up in strategic planning, oftentimes people say, well, if we do the strategic planning and we get things done and we solve problems, people outside of the group will think better of us. And that's true. They will. I don't think that that should be of particular importance to people in the OTL. I don't really care what the opinion of other magical groups is about us. I do care about what our opinion is of ourselves. And I think that all of us coming together, feeling that satisfaction, feeling like the organization actually does things versus spinning about them, feels like it can solve problems effectively, that helps our credibility of ourselves. So whether it has this larger effect on credibility, I'm not that interested in. I'm more interested in how we feel about ourselves and how I think strategic planning will help that. Bishop Barry, who was here last week, actually did an amazing dissertation once on what strategic planning can really help you with, which is opportunity costs. And I wish I had a copy of it with me because it was very, very helpful. Opportunity costs come into play because there's only a limited amount of time and resources that you have at any point in your life. And if you choose to do something, you are, by that choice, choosing not to do a whole bunch of other things. And this rubs everybody the wrong way because in modern life, we want endless opportunities to do everything we want and we want the largest number of choices and no restrictions or cutoffs at all. And that's just not possible. It's just a limited amount of money, just a limited amount of time. Strategic planning helps you manage your opportunity costs by choosing the things that you want to do and realizing that you can't have everything. The other thing that I think strategic planning really helps with is initiative. The more you're actually starting the process and taking the initiative to get something done, the more the universe is generally on your side. In addition, if you are not the person taking the initiative, you are dependent on the people who are taking the initiative. Right? Because somebody out there is going to take initiative, so it might as well be you and your group versus waiting for somebody else to do it so that you have to react to them. And the more you don't strategically plan and don't take initiative, the more you sort of become the bug and everything else becomes the windshield. And you want to be the windshield, you don't want to be the bug. And one of the things that we found in doing organizing and politics is that the more you did the planning, the more you set the tone, you set the agenda, and everyone else had to react to you. And if you didn't do that, then you wound up reacting to everybody else, which is not really where you want to be, especially as thelemic magicians. Do we really want to be under the gun of everybody else around us, being pushed around by what they do? I don't think so. What will strategic planning not do? We just covered what it will do. What will it not do? First of all, strategic planning is no substitute for effective leadership, right? Let's just say we all became the leaders of Theory on Babylon Oasis all of a sudden, you know, kaboom, and we spent the next 4 hours coming together with a plan, gave it to whoever walked in the door and took off for the mountains, the valleys, the oceans white with foam, and decided to, they've got the plan, go ahead, they can deal with it, we're free. That's not how it works. Coming up with a great plan helps your leadership. It is not a substitute for it. And no matter how great your plan is, you're still going to have a leader with vision who can articulate the message of where the group is ultimately going to wind up, influence to keep people on board with the plan as they work on it, and direction to make sure the plan is moving the right way. Coming up with a plan will not eliminate the need for somebody, usually more than one person, to do that. The next thing is, it is no substitute for effective job performance. We've just covered the leadership aspect. If we give people this, if we all have a plan, and we still do a crappy job at everything the plan calls for, it will not help. Right? The plan is not going to be a substitute for us not doing a good job. Lastly, it is no substitute for effective management. That's a little bit different from leadership, but it means making sure that people really are doing their job, staying on top of them. Having a plan is helpful, but it is not going to substitute for that. And my ultimate analogy for this sort of problem is the Shakespeare play Hamlet, put on by kids with Down syndrome in the fourth grade. You know, we go, we watch Hamlet, and we come out and we say, man, that Shakespeare is a terrible playwright. Jesus Christ, he sucks. Okay, no. Shakespeare is an amazing playwright, the immortal bard of Avalon. The kid's doing the play with the people with the problems. And no matter how great your play is, if the actors in it suck, it will not go forward. No matter how great your plan is, we could come up with the best strategic plan. It could be inspired by the gods themselves. And if the people who are tasked with doing it are incompetent, it's not going to work. Does that make sense? Okay, so strategic plan, not the be-all and the end-all, still needs other things. The next stage I'd like to talk about is some myths regarding strategic plan, which is significant because we just told you what it won't do. Myth of strategic planning number one, it's complex. No, it's not. It's painfully, sinfully, stupidly easy. Many simple things are difficult. Many complex things are actually kind of easy once you get into the flow of them. But strategic planning never has to be complex. It can always be broken down into simple stages. Nothing I have told you so far is really that complex. You don't need to be a 7 equals 4, adeptus exemptus in order to understand any of it. You know, high school dropouts working a piece action to grasp these issues pretty quickly. Next, it's new. No, it's old. If you go out and get a new book about strategic planning, even a really good one, the chances are very good that they have gotten it from things that were written 50 years ago. I have been following textbooks on strategic planning for nonprofit organizations for almost 20 years. None of them have anything new to say. So it's always the same old thing. And I was talking with my director not too long ago, and we were sort of rehashing the past and going back through the trajectory of the organization from when we started working for it, when it was nothing, to where it is now. And I said, yeah, it's really kind of an accomplishment when you think about it. And he said, yes, but Keith, we stole all of our ideas from other people. And I said, well, yeah, but we knew the good stuff to steal. And everything in strategic planning has been stolen before. The next thing is you need a guru to help you do strategic planning. You don't. Anyone can get one of these books. It's brain dead easy, and you can do it yourself. So you don't need an expert to do it. I don't really need to be the strategic planning expert for anybody because it's really pretty simple. It costs a lot is another myth. No, it's really cheap. All you need is some time. You don't need to pay anyone to do it for you. It's not expensive. The last myth is that it's a finish at some point. You don't have to do it anymore. That's another myth. You always need a plan. No matter how successful the OTO is, I was talking with a Grand Lodge officer who was saying that, you know, in one of the cities that he has been living in, everything is endowed by a multi-billionaire. Everywhere he goes, everything is, you know, there because of the billionaire's beneficence. And I sometimes think about that in the OTO. What if somebody, you know, like Bill Gates just gave the OTO billions and billions of dollars? Would that mean that we didn't have to do strategic planning anymore? No, we would have to do even more strategic planning to make it even better than it would be were he to give us all this money. So, no, there doesn't have to be any end point to strategic planning. It keeps having to get done. Now, I'm going to run through some arguments against strategic planning. First of all, why do most people in the OTO and in polemic circumstances resist this sort of approach? It interferes with their individual will. Okay, that's helpful. They feel like they're going to be trapped in it, right? The feeling of I'm being trapped in this thing. Well, I kind of feel like unless there's a strategic plan, you're sort of trapped in that. The idea is without a strategic plan, you're somehow free, whereas in fact, I think you're worse off without one than you are with one, basically because, you know, if you're in a tough situation, you know, you're suddenly stranded in a strange city, having a plan is usually better than not having a plan, right? Being out in the desert, the survival situation, being stuck with sharks floating, you better have a plan. So having a plan is better than not having one. There's also more complex arguments about structure and the nature of will, which we won't get into, but I think will become pretty obvious. What's another kind of objection to strategic planning?
It might drive away the people we like.
Right. Do we want to actually get something done, and are we looking to attract people who are saying, yes, this group has a plan, versus the people who, a plan's make me uncomfortable, I'm here to have no plan whatsoever, could you feed me a field grade, thank you. No, that's definitely kind of an issue. I was also thinking of, it might fail. Right? If you don't have a plan, you can never fail. If you have a plan, it might not work. And I think this is significant, but I kind of feel like if you don't have a plan, it's not a guaranteed victory and a gold medal. It's being a schmuck without a plan. And I think taking the risks to fail is what's magical. And if you look at Crowley's own work as a magician, he failed at things all the time. C.F. Russell, who had to type up his diaries at one point, was complaining that Crowley wrote off every single operation he did for a while as a failure. He made mountains and mountains and mountains of failures. And everyone in the OTO that I know, pretty much, is afraid to admit that their magic didn't work. You know, you don't see people getting on LJ going, I spent 3 hours doing this invocation and it was a total failure. Nothing went the way I wanted it to. It was a fucking disaster, right? But Crowley said that stuff all the time in his diaries. Total disaster. Didn't work. So being really magical actually means being strong enough to risk failure. And these folks that are terrified of failing never really get anywhere. There's a classic line, if you're not making mistakes, you're not doing anything else either. And that is really true, I think, with a lot of these OTO bodies that in the past seem to sort of exist on paper and never really did anything. Consequently, you could write that whole thing off as a failure. The next argument that I hear a lot is, we don't have the time to do strategic planning. We're too busy putting on a rites of Eleusis where the rite of Jupiter is hee-haw, right? If you have time to put on all this stuff, you have time to do strategic planning. It doesn't really take that long. This whole idea, you know, we don't have time. In certain instances, that is true. You will not have the time to do strategic planning. For example, if a tornado hit this building right now, we would not have time to do strategic planning. We would have urgent other matters to attend to. You know, fires, disasters, huge catastrophes. At that point, you don't have time to do strategic planning. Most of the time, we have plenty of time to do strategic planning. We just need to make it and stop doing other things. This is to kind of address your thing. It's not magical. This is kind of corporate. You know, I have to do this sort of stuff at my job. I didn't come to the OTO to have to work on plans. Again, Crowley was really into having objects. We can debate about his position on goals, and I think that's reasonable. But we really can't debate his position on objects. And if you go through Crowley's diaries, for example, he will say, object of operation, rich wife. And then he will write, whether he got it or not. That's just one example. But, you know, you can go through Crowley's diaries. Money, gold, a place to stay, magical power, insight. And then he'll write whether the aim was successful or not. So if looking at goals as a magician sort of bothers you, look upon it as aims and see and test whether you get it or not. It's kind of simple. Crowley has a quote that I'm going to read where he says, "When men have a definite aim to pursue, they instinctively find means of overriding mutual interference and may even work together, unselfishly, as it is positively called, to obtain their separate ends with the minimum of friction. But when they are aimless, they become distracted and witless. They push each other aside in their desperation, and even the simplest tasks become impossible. Without strategic planning, that's what happens. If there are problems in the OTO or in other magical organizations, it might be because they don't have plans and aims that are uniting people and getting them all to work together in the way Crowley himself described. Does that make sense? Okay, so to me, it's more magical to have an aim and to have a plan than it is not to have one. It should be organic. These things should come together organically. Often, local body masters will feel that when they get the charter from the Electoral College, that the charter will arrive, they'll take it out of its envelope, and from it, magically, an OTO body will appear. And there'll be, women in costumes and corsets, and guys in black robes with goatees and tattoos, and masks will start. And this is all just going to happen organically. And, when I was on the EC, I saw this happening all the time. People were kind of disappointed that their charter didn't come with a body. And in fact, you have to do this work. Even organic processes have goals and aims inside of them that have to be fulfilled. And oftentimes when someone thinks that it's an organic process happening around them, what's really happening is that a few people have decided to have a plan and are sort of organically guiding the group towards that without being explicit about it. So there are three basic criteria for a good strategic plan. The first is that it is realistic. We may talk a little bit more about that later. Can anyone give me an example of an unrealistic strategic plan?
The aim of an unrealistic strategic plan? Make profit houses.
What?
Let's make profit houses.
Immediate profit houses with no idea of what to do inside of them. That is kind of unrealistic. That's not as unrealistic as I was thinking of. The late Ebony Anpu, would spin ideas about having temples to Babylon on the lunar surface in the Parsons crater. Jack Parsons was named after, there's a crater on the moon named after Jack Parsons. That was his idea. And I had that vision. I could picture, Hans Bach-like, Frank Rosetta-esque structures, with people like walking in and out of them. That is an unrealistic goal because, we don't even know what gravity is going to do with cake of light. We don't know how we're going to get it up there. I'm sorry. It's strike out for realism. Next, it should be flexible. This is often people don't see this about goals, but if your goal doesn't have flexible options built into it at different stages where you can change it, it's not really a good strategic goal. And that should be pretty obvious. Lastly, it should be relevant. Okay, what is an idea of an irrelevant strategic goal for the OTO? I've got one. We're going to open a mead factory. People have seriously, I've heard this at least two or three times, saying the OTO should start a mead factory. It's like, okay, how does that have anything to do with any of the stuff that we've got? Well, it would be cool. We like meat. We could all work there. We don't like our regular jobs, but we like meat. We could sell it. This is not relevant. This has nothing to do with, oh man, come on. Meat. So it has to be relevant. In order for it, that's obvious. So now, having kind of laid out the structure, let's talk a little bit more about what we would do if we were coming up with a strategic plan. Get ready for a Kabbalah-like diagram. First, over here, we have situational analysis. And in our second little Sophrotic-like cloud, you might want to say, is our mission, our vision, and our values. Over here, we have issues. Lots of issues. And over here we have goals. And then we have strategies. Now, who would like to tell me, given this sort of Sophronic-like diagram here, like the tree of life, where the process should start? In what little cloudy sphere should it begin? Should we start with a situational analysis? Or should we start with our mission, our vision, and our values? Should we start down here with our strategies? Or should we start over here with our issues?
Vision.
Yeah, vision.
I hear two votes for vision. Do I hear any votes for situational analysis? Does anyone want to go down here with strategies? Okay. The reason that I bring this up is it's very interesting. The book that I've been studying on this is actually a secret OTO text that I got from the internet, if you can believe it. And it's called The Field Guide to Nonprofit Strategic Planning and Facilitation. And this is actually the book that the OTO is trying to use itself coming up with strategic planning. So when this was announced, I immediately ordered the book and was reading along with the OTO leaders, assuming that they're working with that. And one of the things that the book brought up that I thought was really interesting is that intuitively, we start with our mission statement, our vision, our values, and then sort of proceed this way down into these other things, and lastly we lay out our strategies. And the book basically says that's not always the way you have to work. And a lot of times you don't really know what your values are until you start working on your strategies. And you don't really know what your mission is until you start looking at your issues. And you don't really know what the state of your situation is until you look at the goals. So the idea that it has to proceed in this sort of lightning-like fashion, the sword coming down like this, or the snake going up like that, not really the case. It can be more of an organic kind of process where all of these things inform one another. So I thought that was really significant. Let's talk a little bit about the mission statement, the vision, and the values. Now, one of the things the book points out is that strategic planning is a constant process, right? It's not we're going to do one plan and that's going to be it at the end of time. You have to keep evaluating it, you have to keep looking at it, you have to keep doing it, but every time you do it, you're not going to go through this whole rigmarole in necessarily the same way or put the same emphasis on each part. So, what is the mission? Where is the mission? Do we need to really come up with heavy-duty mission for the OTO? Why not? It's in the blue equinox. Right? I mean, unless we're going to come up with some wild new idea on how to totally reshape it, which I don't think any of us are really that interested in doing, we already have a lot of this stuff. Vision, values, these are things that we already sort of got handed to us, for better or for worse, depending on where you're coming from. But spending a lot of time going back and going through this probably isn't as necessary as people might think. Now, I know that when Bishop Barry was up here, people were talking a lot about the fact that the OTO has a mission statement, it has a vision statement. I don't think any one of us know what those are. Can any one of us just reel off the mission statement for the OTO right now? No? Don't feel bad about that. At my job, we have mission statements. I can't tell you what it is. I should be able to, but I don't. It's on the back of my business card. In fact, I don't know anyone at any job who can sit and just rattle off the mission statement. Do you have a mission statement at your job?
Of course.
Can you rattle off what it is?
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. And one of the best leadership books I saw recently basically said, unless the mission statement is like immediately in the hearts and minds of every executive working for the firm, it's pointless. Don't put it on plaques. Don't put it on posters with soaring eagles. Don't put it on little plastic statues that you give to people at awards dinners. Just make sure that everybody really knows it, because then it becomes a sort of make-work exercise where the executives go off and spend hours and hours and hours crafting a mission statement that nobody gives a damn about. Nonetheless, I still think this is important, because I think we will come to understand the values, the vision, and the mission in the Blue Equinox as we work to put things into effect. So, because I'm prejudiced, I want to move over to situational analysis. This is the part of the strategic goal planning process that I was always pushed out of at my old job. For the most part, they didn't let the staff do a lot of debate about situational analysis, usually because there were unhappy making things in there. like just how low the bank balance really was, or just what the real membership rate in the organization really was, or what, you know, the grim stuff that they didn't want to bum people out with was there. So I'm really fascinated with the situational analysis part. There are two kinds of situational analysis. The first is external analysis. And that is, you know, what's going on outside the group. So for an occult organization, what are some things that we might think about in terms of an external analysis? Even for something like Theory on Babylon, what's an external analysis?
The cost of running the area.
Okay, so economics of the area. We'll just have a broad form of that. What might that include? Things like rent. What else?
Oh, cost of insurance.
Cost of insurance. Also cost of living. How well the economy is doing. Now, I was talking to somebody about an OTO community in the United States, and they said they never recovered from an economic downturn. The whole area is just like bewailing the fate of the 90s. You know, they were great, they were riding high, everything was wonderful, people had loads of money. It went under, it's never come back. So, general economic. Demographics, who lives in the area? You know, if you know, we're in a retirement community in Florida, you know, that's something to keep in mind, right? What else? Here's a sneaky one here. How about the competition? Okay, this is really touchy in nonprofit groups because everybody's like usually liberal and they're like, I don't want to think bad thoughts about the other groups. Those motherland bastards. You know, we don't want to diss the competition. And it gets kind of dicey in our circumstances, but we want to look at what other, you know, spiritual groups that are out there that are like ours are, whether people, we're losing people to them, whether people are coming to us from them, what's the overall climate of the competition, who we recognize as possible competitors. That's important. So those are some things in external analysis. Basically what you're looking at are opportunities and threats, not to put too fine a point on it. All of these things could be opportunities and all these things could be threats. But you have to, in your external situational analysis, you have to look at those two issues. What's an opportunity? What's a threat? Strategic planning tries to maximize opportunities and minimize threats. So what's a threat to the group? Can we think of one? What's a possible threat to TBO? What? What?
Competition.
Yeah, there could be some new occult group that could suddenly spring up and everyone could get really totally involved with them and no one would have time for the OTO anymore. That happens in some areas. It's happened before. Not a real threat that I see happening to us now, but it's possible. So you want to keep an eye out for that. I'm thinking more of something like lawsuit. You know, if we get actual property, if we start owning a lot of property, if we'll real property, then there are unfortunately a lot of people out there with lawyers who want to take it away from us. And they're looking for an opportunity to come in and take that property. And if you don't have any property, there's nothing for them to take. But if you don't have any property, there's not a lot for you either. So that brings up things like insurance, protecting your property, looking at possible threats. That's very important. What are some possible opportunities that we might see externally? For TBO.
Expansion.
Well, in what sense? What's an opportunity? We want to expand.
Increasing the membership.
So that's what we want. We want to do that. That could even be a goal over here. But in terms of our analysis right now, I would say something like, here's an opportunity. We live in an area with a lot of colleges. There's a lot of young people involved. Most of the people tend to join the OTO when they're in their 20s. So I think we could look at this and maybe see if that was statistically true. I know I did. No, I know a lot of people did. So the fact that we're here around all these universities could be a real opportunity for us. It certainly doesn't look like a threat. So these are things to keep in mind. Let's look at some internal analysis. We're looking again at strengths and weaknesses. So what three areas are we going to examine for situational analysis for the group? First, equipment. Originally, we were looking at the fact that we needed to get equipment we didn't have. So our situational analysis was, at the time, whether we knew it or not, when we did it, was we don't have the equipment we need to get it. So that became a goal. Now our equipment's pretty good. Could it be better? Yeah. Are we threatened by crappy equipment that could break down? Not really. There's improvements that could be made, and maybe we need to think about that, but we don't see an immediate threat. Next is personnel, or as I like to call it, the bench from baseball. Who do you have on your bench? So, opportunities. We have a lot of new people who are really into Galima coming to TBF. Downside, not a lot of experience. Okay, this is not like some of the lodges where everybody's like a fifth or sixth degree. They've been anywhere for a long time. They have a huge amount of information about magic. Their classes are very, very heavy and intense. And I was talking to someone who was bragging about their body like that. That's not us. Okay, so that's, we don't have a lot of experience, by and large. There's people here with experience. It's not that, not a major resource at the moment. And lastly is resources. And by that we mean what? Money. Okay, so are we financially stable through the end of the year? No? How about for the next 3 months? Pretty much, right? This is a touchy area for us right now. There's some threats there. Am I correct? Yes, there is. So any goal setting that we do, any issues that we look at, any long-term strategies that we make have got to have all of these things involved in them. And the biggest threat that we can look at right now in terms of a little exercise-like, cursory version of situational analysis, the biggest threat that we're looking at is money. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Significant. Now, having examined our little situational analysis, we then need to proceed to an interesting question, which is, can we do strategic planning? Well, let's answer some questions. Is there money coming in to cover the basic expenses? Pretty much. For the next 3 months, yeah. Okay. We're not about to be pitched out into the street. Okay. Just covering that. Because you know what? If we were, we can't do strategic planning. This whole exercise, even this discussion, is a waste of time. We need to get that money together, right? And get it to the person so that we're not kicked out of the street. Next, will the plans go anywhere? If we were to come up with plans right now, you know, were we the people responsible for coming up with strategic plans, would they go anywhere? If all of us look at each other and go, you know what? I don't think those plans are going anywhere, then we shouldn't do the strategic planning. There's no point. We have to look at why they wouldn't go anywhere first. Is there cynicism about planning in our organization? Now, in the larger OTO structure, I think there is some cynicism about planning, partly because it hasn't been done very successfully in the past, and people are not used to thinking in terms of strategic planning. In our little group, I don't really think there's that much cynicism about it. I don't detect it. No, I don't see people going, oh God, this stuff never works. Goals, no. In fact, I think that most of the people in TBO are pretty gung-ho about planning. We're satisfied. We got some good results with the little planning we've done so far. We think we can go forward with it. But that's something to consider, because why do it if no one thinks it's going to go anywhere and everyone is cynical about it? Do we want to have a plan? If we don't want one, we need to want one. If we'd rather not have one, we need to get people on board to have one. And the question comes is, would we rather have a plan or not have one? I think most of us would rather have a plan. Therefore, I think we're in a position to do strategic planning. But if everybody wasn't interested in it, we shouldn't have it. Are the leaders working together? Yeah. Now again, let's go back and review just quickly. If the leaders aren't working on this strategic plan, is it a strategic plan? If they delegated it out to some schnooks, isn't it a strategic plan? No. They have to be involved. If the leaders can't work together, don't plan. Get the leaders to work together first, then do your planning. Is the CEO going to be around for 3 months? Probably. Okay? If the person in charge of the organization is going to be out the door in like 2 or 3 months, why do a strategic plan? They're not going to be, the new person isn't going to be invested in it, and the old person leaving is going to be, who cares? I'm not going to be around to see this through or not. I'm not invested either. So stable leadership, that's a must. Can people put the time into plan? If they can't, don't have a plan. So Once you can meet all of those questions, then you can have a plan. So finally, as we're going to wrap this up pretty quickly, let's move to the last part of this, which is assuming that we have the plan, we can do all this stuff, we've done the analysis, let's look at the kind of goals that you want to have. And the short version of this are SMART goals. Whenever you come up with goals for a strategic plan, they need to be SMART. And by that, I mean they need to be strategic in that they have to build on each other. They can't be the family guy, boom, 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 as we explained. They have to be measurable. I have a quote about this. Crowley tells us, all sanity, which is all science, is founded upon limit. We must be able to cut off, to define, to measure. Naturally, then, their opposites, insanity and religion, have for their prime characteristic the indefinable, incomprehensible, and immeasurable. So here, I see Crowley kind of giving the measurable part of this a boost. What is an example of an unmeasurable goal?
Increase the membership.
Well, yeah, that's a very good one. Increase it by what? One or two people? Hey, we got a new person in after 8 months.
Yep.
Woo-wee, we met our goal, right? Well, you lost four people. No, but we was to increase. We increased by one.
Yep.
It's not specific. You know, somebody was like, ooh, wisdom, right? That's a goal. We're all going to become wise. How do you do you feel wise? Today I do. Yesterday, when I did stupid things, not so much. Magic, in general, Crowley tells us in magic and theory and practice, is unlike science because it deals with things that are difficult to measure. He doesn't say, stop measuring then and just throw it to the wind and be chaos magicians. Woo! He says, no, you work on actually working harder to measure the results that you are getting. So strategic planning is all about what is measurable. You said increase the membership. Yes. As posited that way as a goal so that we're all watching out the door, woo, we're going to increase the members. That's not really a measurable goal. Increase it by how much? By 10%? By 20%? That's a measurable goal. We want 5 new Minervals in the next 3 months. Now, what's the virtue of that? You will be able to tell. If you got 6, you exceeded your goal. If you got 2, you did not. You failed in getting your goal. So strategic goals have to be measurable. There has to be a metric there. And we see this a lot in the OTO because people keep saying things like, it's getting better. It's getting better. Well, yeah, subjectively, if you want to spin that way, that it is. But you could also say it's getting worse. There are plenty of ways you could say, well, I'm not buying this. So at the same time, if you set a measurable goal, like we're going to do X by X, that way either we'll get met or not. There's no spin possible. The more measurable it is, the more spin resistant it is. Okay, the next one is accountable. A is for accountable. What does that mean? We're going to increase the membership. Is that accountable? Hey, what's my problem? It was angels. Hey, angels, like the rest of you all, didn't do what you were supposed to do. It's not my beef. If individual people are not being held accountable for their part of the strategic goal, it's not a real goal. Who is going to work on that particular part of increasing the membership? What are they going to do? Are you going to man a table at a UC event, you know, from a certain amount of time? So that if somebody doesn't do that, they will be accountable to the leaders and to everyone else, maybe, as to why that didn't happen or why that wasn't done. Now, at my old job, one of our political program directors, people were going around the room talking about their pieces, and my boss realized he, the political program director of the organization, really didn't have any goals that he was accountable for. And this was deliberate, because, you know, he's a nice guy, but didn't want to be held accountable for anything. So I think this is another kind of problem in the community that people tend to resist being held accountable because, again, that's too much like work. But it has to be accountable. Lastly, the goal has to be realistic. Not lastly, almost lastly. The goal has to be realistic. So we've already gone over a little bit about what unrealistic goals are, you know, our Mead factory, the temples on the moon. But what is a realistic goal and how will we know? How do you know what a realistic goal is?
Attainable.
attaining property?
Experience.
Well, yeah, you said attaining property is a goal. Is that a realistic goal? You think it is. How do you know it is? Because a lot of people will say attaining property within the next 5 years for any OTO body is not a realistic goal. Some people will say that it is, but others will say it's not. How do you make the case for it being realistic?
By manifesting it.
Well, what you're basically saying is, I'll know when it's realistic as to whether or not I can do it. But I think your situational analysis of looking at things like resource personnel and all this other stuff should go into determining whether it's realistic or not. But the other point that you make by actually doing it, strategic planning tells you what's realistic and what isn't. And you have to be ready to like fall on your face a few times and say, you know what? We tried, we set a goal, but it wasn't realistic. And this happened a lot of times at my old job. I used to call them SMAT goals. They were strategic. They were measurable. They were accountable. They were not realistic. The R was missing. But I think over time, the more strategic planning you do, the better you get at actually knowing what's a realistic goal and what isn't. Crowley tells us that there are a great many people who quite misunderstand the nature of magic. They have an idea that it is something vague and unreal instead of being, as it is, a direct means of coming into contact with reality. It is these people who pay themselves with phrases and who are always using long words with no definite connotation, who plaster themselves with pompous titles and decorations which mean absolutely nothing whatsoever. With such people, we have nothing to do. I think this is really a challenging part of doing strategic planning for occultists because we're not always that into reality. And Crowley is telling us magic is really about reality. So that's the part we need to, I think, look at most seriously and figure out what's realistic and what isn't. And be ready to make mistakes and say, okay, look, we thought this was a realistic goal. Maybe it wasn't. And be all right with that. For a long time, Crowley has said that his work attracted too many dilettantes and eccentrics, weaklings seeking an escape in magic from reality. And that's the thing that we're really working to overcome. Lastly, we have any smart goal has to be on a timeline. Why? Why should it be on a timeline? I've just said earlier that strategic planning is endless. What's the point? Why have it on a timeline?
You want a measurable goal, you need to know when to measure it.
Right. When does the measuring come? Right? Oh, we're going to increase the membership. Well, it's been decreasing. But no time limit. 2 years from now, it may go up. You can't say that that didn't work. There can be no evaluation at any point as to whether the goal succeeded or not if there isn't a timeline set for it. Does that mean that if you come to the end of the timeline and the goal isn't met, that you beat yourself up? No. That's part of flexibility. You may extend the goal and say, oh, we needed a longer timeline, or you may change the goal and say it didn't work out and pick something else. But you have to have a timeline. And that's why goal setting is often cyclical. You set periods throughout the year, maybe on the solstices, maybe on the equinoxes, to review the goals, look at new ones, and go back through this whole process again. Does that make sense? Okay. I'm going to conclude this, and I thank you for your kind attention, with a quote from Martin Heidegger. He said, "Whether the West still dares to create a goal above itself and its history, or whether it prefers to sink to the level of the preservation and enhancement of trade interests and entertainments, to be satisfied with appealing to the status quo as if this were absolute." And that, I think, is a challenge not just for the OTO and for Theory on Babylon Oasis, but for the entirety of Western civilization. Can we still actually posit goals, or are we just going to accept the status quo and go into the movies as if it was an absolute that we could never escape? So, I thank you for your kind attention.
I hope everybody enjoyed that lecture from Keith 418. I think it's wonderful that we can go out and we can take things that seem antithetical to magic, but actually aren't. Things like goals and planning and strategic planning and all of these other kind of tools and incorporate them in our magical practices to allow us to manifest greater things. So thanks to Keith 418 for helping kind of give an idea on how to do that with strategic planning. And thanks to the folks at Theory on Babylon Oasis who allowed Thelema Coast to Coast to broadcast this lecture. Especially thanks to Peggy for recording it and Chris, the body master out there, for allowing the broadcast. This brings us to the end of show 32. I hope everybody enjoyed this lecture. As I said, show 33 will be a lecture that I gave at Dove and Serpent Oasis in July about Crowley's ontology. Before I go, though, I want to let everybody know that I have a personal blog. Some people have been asking about my blog and how it was restricted from public and things like that. I've created a public blog where I talk about the various aspects of Thelema, the Thelemic community, Thelemic philosophy, and so forth. That can be read at www.thelema.nu. And that's where I kind of go and take some ideas about Thelema and the Thelemic community and really kind of put them through various critical processes, and I write about my ideals. So I appreciate all kinds of feedback on there. It's been going, the website has been out there since mid-July, and I post stuff every few days on it. So I encourage you all to go out and check it out. All right, for the closing song, it is an interesting song that was done by Sobek. It actually takes Crowley's recording of doing the poem At Sea, Three Hymns for Man, and puts it to music. So it's a very short tune, and since this is a long show, I figured it was good to have a small little closing tune. But it's nice to have kind of the acoustic background music to a very good poem. So here is Sobek and Crowley doing At Sea. And thanks again for listening to the show. I hope you stick around for the next one. Love's the law, love under will.
As light has stars, more rare than ships in ocean, faint from pole to pole, so all the wonder of her lips hints her innavigable soul. Such light she gives to guide my bark, but I am swallowed in the swell of her heart's ocean, faintly dark. As old as I am, as old as my health. In her I live, a minute dancing moment in the sun. In her I die, a sterile shoot of my trade in oblivion. In her my self dissolve, a grain of passion purifies my pain to peace, past personality. Love of my life, God of the years, confirm the chrism, robe to bloom. Anointing love, aspurging tears, in the sanctifying solitude. Man is so infinitely small, in all these stars, determinate. Maker and the molder of them all, man is so infinitely great.